this program is intended for people who are blind and who are vision impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. In the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the February 12th, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. I will begin today with a poem by Mina Alexander entitled Coochie by the Sea. The tin roof of the hospital has claw marks, bruised indigo. The kind you left on your thigh, that awful night when no one would come near you. On the road from the hospital, you asked me the prescription, saying, "Bang." Like you're then not short-sighted already. You crane your neck, pull out rain clouds. No key. The sky has pink streaks, shiny as a shell. You always saw those things so well. You were the artistic one, keen and lovely. Why was your shadow self strolling into water, lying and wait for boys, so they could burn away the hurt in me? My black hair, the angular, cut into webbed shapes, flipping like sails. Insects, you hid in the attic, sprawling half-inch creatures, scarlet word balloons jostling their lips, radiant ciphers no one could tell. Your imaginary friends, smeary friends, Susie Kelly with corkscrew curls, mad thumb, axe in hand. Sometimes you gather stray cats, fending milk, from all the refrigerator bits of breath soaked in honey. You sang to them ocean and noah, your voice rising to the locust trees. This road is covered with rocks and dirt. Moses with pilgrims curl past. You squeal at that boy. Ellie, cycle workshop. Close, far too close. Drops of blood splatter us both. You lean sideways. Touch my cheek. Last living coochie, by the sea. Find a house with a white balcony. Apple. I think the angels will call on me. And now, for the credit section. It's Still Alive, 200 years of Frankenstein by Jill Lepore. This essay has been slightly edited in length for this broadcast. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley began writing Frankenstein with the modern Prometheus when she was 18 years old, two years after she became pregnant with her first child, a baby she did not name. Quote, nurse the baby, read, end quote. She had written in her diary day after day, until the 11th day, quote, I awoke the night, didn't expect it, appeared to be sleeping so quietly, that I would not awake it, end quote. And then in the morning, quote, find my baby dead, end quote. With grief and eyeballs came a fear of a, quote, fever from the milk, end quote. Her breasts were swollen, inflamed, unsucked, her slip too revered. Quote, dream that my little baby came to life again, that it had been, and it had only been cold, and that we rubbed it before the fire, that it lived, end quote. She wrote in her diary, quote, awake. Then only weeks later, she was still likely nursing her second baby when she started writing Frankenstein, and pregnant with her third by the time he finished. She didn't put her name in her book. She published Frankenstein anonymously, in 1818, not least out of concern that she might lose custody of her children. And she didn't give her monster a name either. Quote, this anonymous android demon, end quote, one reviewer called it, further called it, for the first theatrical production of Frankenstein, staged in London in 1823, by which time the author had given birth to four children, buried three, and lost another unnamed baby to a miscarriage so severe that she nearly died here, that she nearly died of bleeding, and saw it only when her husband had her set on ice. The monster was listed on the playbill as a blank line. Quote, this nameless mode of naming the unnameable is rather good, end quote. Shelley remarked about the creature's theatrical villain. She herself had no name of her own. Like the creature, pieced together from cadavers collected back to Frankenstein, her name was a symbol to parts. The name of her mother, the feminist Mary Wollstonecraft, steps to that of her father, the philosopher William Godwin, crafted onto that of her husband, the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, as if Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley were the son of her relations, bone of their bone and flesh of their flesh. If not the milk of her mother's milk, milk of her mother's milk, since her mother had died 11 days after giving birth to her, mainly to suck. Awoke and found no mother. Quote, it was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils, end quote. End quote. Dr. Frankenstein, the university student says, pouring out his tale. The rain patters on the window pane. The bleak light flickers from a dying candle. He looks at the, quote, lifeless thing, end quote. This thing, end quote, at his feet comes life. Quote, I saw the dull yellow eye above the dull yellow eye of a creature open. It breathes hard and a compart in a convulsive motion agitated its limbs, end quote. Having labored so long to bring the creature's life, he finds himself disgusted and horrified, quote, unable to endure the aspect of the being that I had created, end quote. And he flees, abandoning his creation, unnamed, quote, I, the miserable, and the abandoned, and had abortion, end quote. The creature says, before, in the book's final scene, he disappears on a raft of ice. This. Frankenstein is for sure reason one, an allegory, a fable, an epistolary novel, and an autobiography. A chaos of literary fertility that left its very own author at days, freshman, end quote. In the introduction, she wrote for Realization in 1831, she took up the humiliating question, quote, how I, then a young girl, came to think of, and to dilate upon some very phase and idea, end quote. And made up a story in which she virtually erased herself as an author, insisting that the story had come from her in a dream. Quote, I saw, with shut eyes, but acute mental vision, I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put in her, end quote. And at writing it consisted of, quote, making only a transcript, end quote, of that dream. A century later, a lurching, grunting, Boris Karloff played the preacher in Universal Pictures Brilliant, 1930 by Bram Shelley Frankenstein, directed by James Whale, the monster. Prodigiously eloquent, learned, and persuasive in the novel, was no longer merely nameless, but all but speechless too. As if what Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley had to say was too radical to be heard, an agony unutterable. Every book is a baby born. But Frankenstein is often supposed to have been more assembled and written in a natural birth, as though all that the author had done were pieced together the writings of other, especially those of her father and her husband. Quote, if Godwin's daughter could not help philosophizing, end quote, one mid-twitcher, 20th century critic wrote, quote, Shelley's wife knew also that the morbid, the occult, the scientifically bizarre, end quote. This enduring condescension, the idea of the author as a vessel for the ideas of other people, the fiction in which the author participated, so as to avoid the scandal of her own brain, goes some way to explaining why Frankenstein has created so many wildly different and irreconcilable readings and restrictions in the two centuries since its publication. For Tricentennial, the original 1818 edition has been reissued as a trimline paper back. Foolish by Penguin Classics, with an introduction by distinguished biographer Charlotte Morton. It is a beautifully illustrated hardcover keepsake, the new annotated Frankenstein, published by Livewright, and annotated by Nestle S. Cleaner. Universal is developing a new Bride of Frankenstein as part of the series of remakes from the back of horror movies. Film arts recapitulating political chicanery, the age of the superhero is about to yield to the age of the monster. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin was 15 years old when she met Percy Bysshe Shelley in 1812. He was 20 and married with a pregnant wife. Having been thrown out of Oxford for his atheism and disowned by his father, William had sought out William Godwin, his intellectual hero, as a surrogate father. Shelley and Godwin spent their illicit courtship, as much romanticism as romance, passionately reading the works of her parents, seeing the works of her parents, or reclining on Wollstonecraft's grave in the St. Pancras Churchyard. Quote, go to the tomb and read, end quote. She wrote in her diary, quote, go with Shelley to the churchyard, end quote. Plainly, they were doing more than reading, because she was pregnant and she ran away with him, fleeing her father's house in a half flight of night, longing for stepsister, Claire Claremont, who wanted to be ruined, too. If any man served as an inspiration for Victor Frankenstein, it was Lord Byron, who followed his imagination, indulged his passions, and abandoned his children. He was, quote, bad, and dangerous to know, end quote, as one of his letters pronounced, namely because of his many affairs, which likely included sleeping with his half-sister, Augusta Lee. Byron married in January 1815, and another Ada was born in December. But when his wife left him in the year of their marriage, Byron was forced never to see his wife or daughter again, lest his wife reveal the scandal of his affair with Lee. Ada was out of the age, Mary Adams, first day would have been, as she lived. Ada's mother fearing that the girl might grow up to become a poet, as mad and bad as her father, raised her instead to be a mathematician. Ada Lovelace, a scientist as imaginative as Victor Frankenstein, would in 1843 provide an influential theoretical description of a general-purpose computer, a century before one was built. In the spring of 1816, Byron, fleeing scandal, left England for Geneva, and was there that he met up with Percy Shelley, Mary Godwin, and Claire Claremont. Moralizers called them the League of Incest. But summer, Claremont was pregnant by Byron was bored, and one evening he announced, quote, we will each write a ghost story, end quote. Godwin began a story, then would later become Frankenstein. Byron later wrote, quote, methinks it is a wonderful book, for a girl of 19, indeed, at that time, end quote. During the months when Godwin was turning her ghost story into a novel, and nursing yet another creature in her belly, Shelley's wife, pregnant now with what would have been their third child, killed herself. Claremont gave birth to a girl, Byron's, but most people assumed it was Shelley's, and Shelley and Godwin got married. For a time, they attempted to move out the girl, but Byron later took her, having noticed that nearly all Godwin and Shelley's children had died. Quote, I so completely disapprove of the mother of children's pregnant in their family, that I should look upon God as going into a hospital, and quote, he wrote cruelly about Shelley's, quote, please, quote, that they reared one, end quote. Byron, by no means interested in marrying a child himself, placing her in a convent where she died at the age of five. When Frankenstein begun in December 1816, was published 18 months later. It bore an unsigned preface by Percy Shelley, in a daily, in a dedication to William Button. The book became an immediate sensation. Quote, it seems to be universally known and read, end quote, a friend wrote to Percy Shelley. Sir Walter Scott wrote in an earlier review, quote, the author seems to use and disclose uncommon powers of poetic imagination, end quote. Scott, like many readers, assumed that the author was Percy Shelley. Reviewers less enamored of the romantic poet, but the romantic poet damned the book's Cotton radicalism and its ironic impieties. John Croker, conservative member of Parliament, called Frankenstein a, quote, Frankenstein a, quote, tissue of horrible and disgusting absurdity, end quote, radical, unhinged, and immoral. But the politics of Frankenstein are as intricate as the structure of stories nested like Russian balls. The outermost goal is a set of letters from an English adventurer to his sister, recounting his Arctic expedition and his meeting with the strange, emaciated, haunted victim Frankenstein. With an adventurer's account, Frankenstein tells the story of his fateful experiment, which is led him to pursue his creature to the ends of the earth. And within Frankenstein's story lies the tale told by the creature itself, the littlest innermost Russian doll, the baby. Foul structure meant that those opposed to political radicalism often found themselves baffled and bewildered by Frankenstein. As literary critics such as Chris Baldick and Adriana Russia have pointed out, the doll appears to be heretical and revolutionary. It also appears to be kind of revolutionary. It all depends on which doll is when the talking. If Frankenstein is a referendum on the French Revolution, the Socratic subreddit, Victor Frankenstein's politics align nicely with those of Edmund Burke, who described violent revolution as, quote, a species of political monster, which has always ended by devouring those who have produced it, end quote. The preacher's own politics, though, align not with Burke's, but with those of Edmund Burke's keenest adversaries. Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin. Victor Frankenstein has made use of other men's bodies, of the lord over the peasantry, or king over his subjects, in just the way that Godwin denounced when he described feudalism as a ferocious monster, end quote. But how dare you sport thus with life, the creature as his maker? The creature, born innocent, has been treated so terribly, that he has become a villain, and just the way that Wollstonecraft predicted. Quote, people are rendered ferocious by misery, anxious by misery, she wrote, and, quote, and misanthropy is ever the offspring of discontent, end quote. Make me happy, end quote, the creature begs Frankenstein, now available. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin Shelley took pains to reduce sympathy, not only with Frankenstein, who's suffering is dreadful, but also with the creature, who's suffering is worse. The art of the book lies in the way Shelley judges reader sympathy, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, every even line by line, from Frankenstein to the creature, even when it comes to the creature's vicious murders, first of Frankenstein's little brother, then of his best friend, and finally his bride. Most evidence suggests that she succeeded. Quote, the justice is indisputably on his side, end quote, one critic wrote in 1824, quote, and his sufferings are, to me, touching in the last degree, inquiry, end quote. Hear my tale, the creature insists, may at last confront his creator. What follows is the autobiography of that infant. He awoke, and all was confusion. Quote, I was a poor, helpless, miserable, reckless, miserable wretch. I knew and could distinguish nothing, end quote. He was cold and naked and hungry and bereft of company, and yet, having no language, was unable even to name these sensations. Quote, but feeling pain and nightmare on all sides, I sat down and wept, end quote. He learned to walk, and began to wander, still unable to speak. Quote, the uncouth and inarticulate sound which broke from me frightened me into silence again, end quote. Eventually, he fell shelter and leaned to adjacent to a cottage alongside a wood, where observing the cottagers talk, he learned of the existence of language. I discovered the names that were given to some of the most familiar objects of discourse. I learned and applied the words fire, milk, bread, and wood. Watching the cottagers read a book, Ruins of Empires, by the 18th century French revolutionary, the month of dictionary, the cult of the whole day, he both learned how to read and acquired, quote, aid and acquired, quote, a cursory knowledge of history, end quote, of litany and injustice. Quote, I heard of the divisions of property, of women's wealth, and swallowed poverty, of rank, descent, and noble blood, end quote. He learned that the weak are everywhere abused by the powerful and the poor despised. So Walter Scott found this the most preposterous part of Frankenstein, quote, that he should have not only learned this week, but to this week, but to read, and for aught we know to write, that he should have become acquainted with Werther, with Plutarch's lives, and with Paradise Lost, by listening through a hole in a wall, seems as unlikely as that he should have acquired, in the same way, the problems of Euclid, or the arts of Euclid, of the art of bookkeeping, a single and double entry, end quote, entry, end quote. But the creature's guide of his education very closely follows the convention of a genre of writing Farnesis from Fatsbones from Fatsbone, the slave narrative. Frederick Douglass born into slavery the year Frankenstein was published. Solomon Sand Conventions. In his autobiography, he described learning to read by training with white boys for lessons. Douglass realized his political condition at the age of 12 while reading a dialogue between a master and slave, reprinted in the Columbian or Oracle. A book for which he 50 cents, and which was one of the only things he wrote with him when he escaped from slavery. It was his claim that age. The more I read, the more I was led to a horror and I guess my enslavers, end quote. Douglass wrote, in a line, the creature himself might have written. Likewise, the creature comes of age when he finds Frankenstein's notebook, recounting his experiment, and learns how he was created, and with what injustice he has been treated. It's at this moment that the creature's tale is transformed from the autobiography of an infant to the autobiography of a slave. Quote, I would at times feel that learning to read had been a curse rather than a blessing, end quote, Douglass wrote. Quote, it had given me a view of my basic condition without the remedy, end quote. So to the creature, quote, increase of knowledge only discovered to me more clearly what a wretched outcast I was, end quote. Douglass, quote, I often found myself regretting my own existence and wishing myself dead, end quote. The creature, quote, cursed creator, lost creator, why did I live, end quote. Douglass seeks his escape. The creature seeks his revenge. Among the main moral and political ambiguities of Schiller's novel, is the question of whether Victor Frankenstein is to be blamed for creating the monster, usurping the power of God and of women, or for faith of women, or for failing to love, care for, and educate. The Frankenstein is Oppenheimer model considers only the former, which makes for a weak reading of the novel. Was Frankenstein participant in the debate of revolution? The several critics have still observed in the revolution on which the novel most plainly termed, is not the one in France, but the one in Haiti. Frailishness in England, the Haitian Revolution, along with continued slavery in Jamaica and other West Indian Sugar Islands, raised deeper and harder questions about liberty and equality than the revolution in France had, since they involved an inquiry into the idea of racial difference. Godwin and Wollstonecraft and analysis, as were both Percy and Mary Shelley, who, for instance, refused to eat sugar because of how it was produced. While Britain and the United States enacted laws abolishing the importation of slaves in 1807, the debate over slavery in Britain's territories continued through the decision in favor of emancipation in 1833. Both Shelley's closely followed this debate, and in the years before and during the composition of Frankenstein they together wrote several books about Africa and the West Indies. Percy Shelley was among those abolitionists who urged not immediate but rational emancipation, fearing that the enslaved, so long into violently repressed and unrepressed and denied education, would, if unconditionally freed, seek vengeance of blood. He asked, quote, can he, who the day before was a trampled slave, suddenly become liberal-minded, forbearing, and independent, end quote. Given Mary Shelley's reading of books that stress the physical distinctiveness of Africans, her depiction of the creature is explicitly racial, figuring him as African as opposed to European. Quote, I was more agile than they, and could subsist upon coarser diet, end quote, the creature says. Quote, I bore the extremes of heat, and cold with less injury to my frame, but to my frame, my stature far exceeded theirs, end quote. This characterization became on stage a caricature. Beginning with the 1823 stage production of Frankenstein, the actor Blaine, warbling face paint, the color that identified him as dead, then as colored. It was in this production that George Canning, abolitionist, foreign secretary, and leader of the House of Commons, invoked in 1824 during a parliamentary debate about emancipation. Tellingly, Canning's remarks brought together the novel depiction of the creature as a baby, and the cultures figuring of Africans as children. Quote, in dealing with the Negro, sir, we must remember that we are dealing with a being possessing the form and strength of a man, that he elect only but a child. To turn him loose in the manhood of his physical strength and the maturity of his physical passions, let any embassy of his unstructed reason would be to raise up a creature resembling the splendid fiction of a recent romance. In the later 19th century stage productions, the creature was explicitly addressed as an African. Even the 1931 James Whale film, in which Karloff wore green face paint, further assists figuring of the creature as black. He is, in the films, I met that scene, lynched. Because the creature reads as a slave, Frankenstein's slave, Frankenstein holds a unique place in American culture. As the literary scholar Elizabeth Young argued a few years ago in Black Frankenstein, the making of an American metaphor. What is the use of living? When in fact I am dead, the Black abolitionist David Walker asked from Boston in 1829 in his book, "The Ultimate Colored Citizens of the World, anticipating Gilbert's papers sold on ice by a century and a half. Quote, slavery is everywhere the pet monster of the American people, end quote, from was declared in New York on the eve of the American Civil War. That drama was called Monster, and sold Monster, and so was Sean Brown. By the 1850s, Frankenstein's monster regularly appeared in American political cartoons as a nude cartoon, as a nearly naked black man, signifying slavery itself, seeking his vengeance upon the nation that created him. Mary Wollstonecraft found that Shelley was dead, by then. Her own chaotic origins are already forgotten. Nearly everyone she loved died before she did. Most of them when she was still very young. Her half-sister Fanny and Mike took her own life in 1816. Percy Shelley drowned in 1822. Lord Byron fell ill and died in Greece in 1824. Maybe Mary Wollstonecraft died with Shelley, as she put it, quote, the last relic of a beloved race. My companions extinct before me, end quote. She chose that as the theme behind the novel she wrote eight years after Frankenstein. Published in 1826, when the other was 28, The Last Man is set in the 21st century, and only one man endures, the lone survivor of a terrible plague, and failed for all his knowledge, to save the life of a single person. Nurse the baby, read, find my baby dead. And now, in the book section, past section, after the fall, during drawing the right lessons from Decline and Violent Crime, by Adam Bodnick. This essay has also been edited slightly by the Wreck Esther. Negatives go by unseen, always by the smaller stuff. Things happen underground, walking by the little web parades. Truly underground, sometimes. 1858, pretenders and politicians in Britain were assessing over the British government's takeover of India from the East India from the East India Company and the intentions of Napoleon III. Yet the really big thing was, the construction of the supervisory genius of the great engineer, Joseph Ozolpiath, of a sewer system to protect London from its own waste, and so arrest the smelly miasma, wrinkly miasma, that a kind of crisis conditions have here. This underground system, along with its visible embankments, would both directly, by example, save countless lives in the developed world during the next century. Making cholera epidemics, for instance, within the distant past, built in relative invisibility. In the United States, over the past 3 decades, while people argue about tax cuts and terrorism, the wave of social change that has most altered the shape of American life, as much as the new embankments of the Thames, change life then has been what the NYU sociologist Patrick Sharkey calls, quote, the great crime decline, end quote. The same term seems to have originated with the influential Berkeley criminologist Franklin E. Zimmering, refers to the still puzzling disappearance from our big city streets of violent crime. So long, the warping force of American life, driving white flight in the suburbs and fueling the rise of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, not to mention the career of Martin Scorsese. Taxi driver is the great Omaha, New York, around the high crime, with steam coming out of college manholes, and violence recumbent in the back seat. But it was so cunning, and this so cunning, and the still hotter thing is that, once it came, no one seemed adequately equipped to praise it. Sharkey, who came of age in that safer era, intends to be its eulogist. He begins his remarkable new book, Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, The Renewal of City Life, The Next War on Violence, published by Norton, and Mrs. by Norton, in the South Bronx, at a city block, near Yankee Stadium, and recalls Yankee Stadium, and recalls time in the 1970s, whose climax was the fierce black riots in 1977, when he and the stadium was harshly attended. Quote, in some years, night games drew 10,000 games drew 10,000 fewer fans than day games. End quote. He writes, many New Yorkers were unwilling to make their way into the Bronx after dark. Quote, spaces that had been created to support Buttoncliff, to be enjoyed by all. Those that define city life in America's greatest metropolis, were dominated by the threat of violence. End quote. Now, he says, quote, the calm of Forest Park reflected the atmosphere of peace in New York City. In the city where more than 2,000 people used to be murdered each year, 328 were killed in 2014, the lowest tally since the first half of the 20th century. Last year, the tally was still lower. And it wasn't just New York. Violent crime fell in Atlanta, Dallas, Los Angeles, and Washington. And not by a little, but by a lot. More important, the quality of life changed dramatically, particularly for the most vulnerable. Sharkey, studying the crime decline in such American cities, concludes, quote, as the degree of violence has fallen, the gap between the neighborhoods of the poor and the non-poor has narrowed. In Cleveland, in the 80s, the level of violence in poor neighborhoods was about 70% higher than the rest of the city. By 2010, that number had dropped to 24%. Their reduction of fear allowed much else to blossom. Quote, subway cars, near lines and buses in U.S. cities filled up as residents and commuters became more willing to leave their cars behind and travel to and from work together. Fans came back to Yankee Stadium and came back to Yankee Stadium in their runs, and just as many began to show up for night games as for day games. End quote. The big city was revived. From Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, the transformation of America's any inner cities from wastelands to self-conscious espresso zones became the comedy of our time. Yet, little trace of this transformation troubles our heart, re-animate our public discourse. Our, abundance, we take the great clock, crime decline for granted, crime decline for granted. We're focused on the trouble sins that create. What kind of house and pray? What kind of house and crisis in San Francisco or Brooklyn? Even when we pay attention to the comedy, pay attention to the comedy, we rarely look at the cause. So our politicians even pretend it hasn't happened. With Donald Trump continuing to campaign against crime and carnage, where it scarcely exists. If people really thought that urban crime still flourished, of course, he would be able to stop donuts with his name on them on the far west side of Manhattan. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, meanwhile, feels free to tell the outrageous lie that, quote, for the first time in a long time, Americans can have hope for a safer future, end quote. This lack of appreciation is partly a question of media attention deficit, this media attention deficit disorder. If there is little news value ignored by men, there is none whatsoever in vogue, just not by men. It is part of a neutral, unseen background of events, even if there had previously been an epidemic of dog bites. Sharking, among many of his peers on the left, regards the great decline as unmediated good, benefiting everyone, and above all, the poorest and most vulnerable. Sharpie's book, in fact, illustrates why social science, with all the uncertainties built into a field in which you are studying, the actions of several million autonomous agents who have altered their actions out of them, with several thousand outliers, guarantee that events would be bizarrely atypical. Still, really is science. What makes it science is what makes it social. An insistence on paying attention to the facts that other people are gathered, even when they conflict with the way you want the world to be. Have you reluctance to tailor the facts to one's views instead of one's views to the facts? Sure, case subsequent research show that children respond to the stress of community violence in a similar way. When children take a standardized test shortly after a neighborhood murder, your scores suffer. The price of a crime is paid, however, by all the trauma of kids whose parents can't buy their way out of this crisis. Quote, local violence does not make children less intelligent or less intelligent, end quote, Charlie says. Quote, rather it occupies their minds, end quote. Thinking about a threat wins you less room to think about anything else. The social cost of street crime, therefore, is far higher than the price of lives lost to bodies maimed. It can maim minds, too. Conversely, Sharkey finds that in places where violence has declined most, kids do much better at school, minority kids lag least. Anyone who says that the decline in crime is a white person's prerogative and pleasure hasn't been following the facts. But what made the crime wave happen and what made it hold? As narrow-minded people, we want the real cause of the crime. Declining nice people doing nice things with no role for nasty people doing nasty things to those still nastier. And Sharkey makes heroes persuasively of many nice people doing nice things to stop crime. He's an enthusiast of the hypothesis the local community organizing was a key factor in the crime era. Quote, I'm sorry, work hard residents, organized into community groups and block clubs that pass more urban neighborhoods, end quote. He thinks that technology, surveillance cameras, no check systems, play a part. But he also finds that incarceration put down for some crime decline, and some bit more aggressive policing. Quote, federal funding paid for tens of thousands of new police officers, end quote, he writes. Quote, the tactics they use were sometimes oppressive, and sometimes brutal, but were also more effective, focusing resources on the precise locations where crime was most intense, end quote. Here, some ambiguity arises. What's now called stop and frisk policing, in which police aggressively sought out suspected minor criminals on the street, most of the minority kids, was, he suggests, a kind of schismatic variant of what Edwards would be called more benignly, quote, Burmese, quote, broken windows, end quote, policing. A Sharkey notes, broken windows policing was based on a theory that was offered without any real evidentiary basis, and published in The Atlantic, not in a peer-reviewed journal. What was easily missed was that the broken windows tactic, that's for just tactic, as first articulated by the criminologist James Q. Wilson, Edward Wilson, in 1982, was not an appeal to the power of policing, It was an appeal to the power of self-policing. At a time when policing had been reduced in many American cities, to having wary patrolmen drive around in sport cars, waiting for a radio call telling them that something bad had already happened. The new theory insisted on an aggressive pursuit of petty crime before it began to be big crime. If a cop led the way, and this was the crucial idea, the community would follow. Blocks left intact, windows were intact, windows repaired by conscientious landlords would produce the eyes on the street and the small scale intense local engagement that had in the past assured the safety of local neighborhoods. South Philadelphia, where the process ran concourse in the 1950s and the 1950s, had been largely benign places. Not because the police were present, but because there were so many engaged passerbys that the police didn't need to be present. This same theory of self-policing soon became its own opposite. A new, not just pushing group. It would be all police all the time. If enough police were frisking minority kids, they would find enough weed and weaponry to send them away. What's that way? The potential criminals, known to be so annoying that their possessions of weed and weaponry could not be street criminals spitted on the street. By the time we were right outside, the window of opportunity for committing crimes would have largely passed. Crime, like gymnastics, being an occupation of the young. view, and Calvin's view. Liberal-minded people do not merely want mass incarceration to be the moral scandal it obviously is. We want it to be a practical scandal as well. It won't and can't do any good. But, shocking reports, the fact suggests that for some period under some measure of decree, it did contribute to the crime headline. It's just the most expensive and efficient and cruel of all ways to combat the crime wave. And the moral horror thereby incurred is intolerable to a liberal democracy that does not want the headbands of men under permanent penal restraint. The social cause of that mass incarceration is a high, at the crime wave, and does not hamper. Sharkey's finite thesis is that the real challenge for the decades to come is to take advantage of the declining crime and engineer a parallel decline in incarceration, sending non-career criminals back to safer streets. Sharkey, as good as he is at explaining what happened, when it helped, what it permitted, isn't as good at explaining why it happened. The curious truth is that the declining crime happened across the entire Western world, in East London, just as it did in the South Bronx. At the same time, the relative decline in New York was significantly bigger than elsewhere. Sharkey's guess that the crime decline can be attributed to be uncomfortable, but potent intersection of community action and coercive election and coercive policing seems about as good as any. Here he echoes Zimmerman's earlier conclusion that many small walls are a better barrier to crime than any single big one. Still, the magnitude of the shift remains mystifying. The conversion might be the contemporaneous war on drug driving. There too, the declining deaths has been impressive. And there too, there's no one solution by most of them. Ranging from those against drug driving campaign to raise wages for legal drinking. With the crime wave, it would seem small measures that push the numbers down by some noticeable amount, in general, virtuous circle that brought the numbers farther and farther down. You didn't have to change the incidence of crime a lot that make people worry less about it. What ended violent crime in this scenario was not an edict, but a feedback system, created when less crime brought more eyes on the streets and subways, which in turn reduced crime, leading to people feeling safer, which in turn brought more eyes out. A self-organized response of society to crime was, in effect, to outnumber the muggers on the street before they mugged someone. One has only to get on the New York City subway at 3 a.m. and recall what 3 a.m. on the New York subway, 3 a.m. on the New York City subway was like 30 years ago, since the presence of this circle. The negative side of this change lies in the supposed production of most diverse neighborhoods demolished on yucky dormitories. Sharkey's take on the process, routine called gentrification, is surprising. He reports that in New York there is, quote, no evidence that gentrification leads to any detectable increase in displacement, end quote. The fear of cultural displacement is, he thinks, another story. Research by the sociologist Nance Freeland suggests that much good happens for residents when neighborhoods become more economically diverse and safer, attracting new resources for schools, new businesses, and new attention from public agencies, end quote. Sharkey's in a story without the usual heroes, but also without the usual victims. Sharkey ends with a curious formula. We must now fight a war on violence, he says, which seems to include a war against police violence. But one thought of a companion understanding that police play a crucial role in the effort to maintain social order, end quote. And that the most vulnerable among us are those most hurt by the loss of order. Peace and order, end quote, is effectively his platform, as, quote, law and order, end quote, was once that, under, end quote, was once that, under, but to be right, they capitalized on the crime wave. He believes that peace and order, and here his vision, does have something in common with that of the libertarians. He would like to welcome to the cause, can only emerge from the ground up. As ways of keeping a durable social peace, he returns again and again to small community works, like those community interpreters, or what he calls, quote, community word-based, end quote. Or even self-policing by Aboriginal Australians. The paradox emerges here. Crime is immune to party politics, seems enormously sensitive to something as similarly anodyne as community policing. One thing that the crime decline may force us to do is look again at what we mean by city. At a time when cities become even ever larger, larger megalopolises, it seems beneficial to insist on the primacy of neighborhoods and communities as units. And yet some evidence suggests that that is where this big change began. Somewhat surprisingly, Sharkey gives a significant and welcome nod to the urban oracle, Jane Jacobs, whose fresh sonic deoccupation of New York streets might, after so many wars, has seemed as dated as the account of Jerusalem before the fall of the devil. But he italicizes her essential lesson. Politics may not all be local. Trump is a refutation of that, winning the allegiance of localities, and he can't or won't serve the city life as, quote, social cohesion, trust, and shared commitment to the community, end quote, Sharkey says, vary from neighborhood to neighborhood. In ones where they are strong, violence almost vanishes. It isn't that poor neighborhoods produce violent crime. The problem is rather, quote, the concentrated poverty tends to slowly tear apart the social fabric of neighborhoods, end quote. restore the social fabric first, and the crime ends, and the crime ends not long after. The city was one guy, How to make social fabric stronger. Sharky offers the immensely cheering pictures of the possibility of spending money to build communities and replacing the noxious, worn the noxious warrior crop with those community quarterbacks. Sorry, making a war, essential career for young urbanists, even though such a country sounds at least questionable as a source of crime stopping. But the lesson of wise public works is not, truth be told, always about the benefits of national analysis, or fundamental change. An epidemic of violence was resolved without addressing its underlying disorders. We cured the crime wave without fixing, quote, the broken black family, and open black family, end quote. That neocon bugaboo. For that matter, we cured it without greater income equality, or even remotely solving the gun problem. The story of the crime decline is about the wisdom of single steps. It's all sanities. We could end cholera, without really understanding how cholera bacteria work. We have curbed crime without knowing how we did it. Perhaps simply good way, many ways at once. It is possible to see this as a kind of humanist miracle. A lesson about the self-organizing, and sometimes self-healing capacities of human communities. As humbling in this way, as an industry, the faith can offer. And finally, a poem by Matthew Beckman, entitled Rhododendron. People praise you a vengeful God because they seek revenge. They choose a God who hates what they hate, but also made the city and the square. I am walking my infant son to stand a rhododendron. Therese. It feels like we are walking through a cloud of jellyfish, made of pink and purple paper, petals falling to the ground. These jellyfish are the fish of spring. He's making sounds like a mouse, small, but all out of his body, inside his organs are so new. They are both organs and the beginning of organs. When he cries for his mother to nurse him, he sounds like a rooster. He is not just hungry, but hunger itself. He is the thing he cries for. Sunlight is turning the rhododendrons into balls of pink light. If balls of pink light, if light were liquid and something else, smashing, that's what the pink is doing. Splashing all over us, looking without God, animals, under the bright pink idea of Earth. We ran out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it. And be sure to listen next time when I read another trend radio page list. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, they bring a beard. This podcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, Trolleycast, on our website, RandallReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138 or 5138. So until next time, so long everybody, this is Evan Mercer.